tonight on Arena. Ronan and Daniel Day-Lewis on their new film, Joel Edgerton and Clint Bentley on Train Dreams, and Andrew O'Hagan on Friendship. Welcome along to Arena for a Monday night. You can text us on 51551. Arena at rte.ie is the email address as usual. We are on Instagram at rte_arena. It was always going to take something extraordinary to tempt Daniel Day-Lewis back onto the big screen. And so, 8 years after his last work in The Phantom Thread, the three-time Oscar winner is back with his new film Anemone, which he co-wrote with his son Ronan Day-Lewis, and which Ronan also directs. The film tells the story of Ray and Jem, two brothers played by Daniel Day-Lewis and Sean Bean. Ray is a recluse living in self-inflicted solitude in remote woodland in an attempt to deal with his many demons. But splendid isolation can't go on forever, and Sean Bean's Jem seeks out Ray in an effort to connect with his brother and force him to face up to his present and his past. It's a past which is haunted by his time as a British Army soldier during the Troubles in the North. The story explores complex dynamics of brotherhood, fatherhood, and the never-ending impact of conflict. In an exclusive Irish interview, Arena's Sinead Egan recently spoke to Daniel Day-Lewis and Ronan Day-Lewis about the project and what it was like to work both as father and son, but also as actor and director. But before we bring you that conversation, let's get a flavour of the film. In this scene, Jem and Ray have a difficult interaction about their father.
My dad prayed for you too. Every day for the rest of his life.
Have you gone soft? That miserable bastard. Oh, he prayed. He prayed, didn't he? Prayed every time he took his belt off. Didn't he pray again afterwards? Wet under the arms from the efforts of his labour, or he prayed regular. We learnt our violence from the number one regional champion, and he had some stiff competition.
Daniel and Ronan Day-Lewis, you're both very welcome to Arena. Daniel, what was it about this project and specifically collaborating with Ronan that got you back on screen again?
Yeah, there really wasn't any project other than the pure wish for me, you know, my part to try and find a way of working with Ronan, because I knew that Ro was going to go on to make films and I had no immediate plans to go back to working as an actor, but there was a sadness in that for me because I love the idea of us working together. Over the years, we've worked on different things together, and it was just the pure... So without really any real plan, it was the pure wish just to try and cook something up between us.
And on that, like, was there a moment during the filming or during the shoot where you thought, yes, this is why I came back, this is what I love, this is what I've been missing?
I think really the entirety of it, quite honestly. I mean, even which included the writing process, which was sort of brand new to me. It was just a pure pleasure to be shoulder to shoulder with Ronan. We only ever wrote when we were in the same room together, which I think was a good decision. It took a bit longer to do because of that, but it was just, there was no. I don't think I ever stopped to think, I'm glad to be doing this again. I was just glad to be doing it again without even thinking about it. Yeah.
I remember when you spoke to Marion Finucane in 2007, you talked about how you take breaks from acting and that the point was to allow the field to go fallow. And
yes.
I wondered, did you have a sense of the benefit of that with this project?
You mean beforehand or after?
Well, no, I suppose what I'm asking is, what impact did the time away have on your approach to this work?
And I think that this was no different in that respect in terms of the cycle. Obviously, it was a much longer cycle and I didn't really expect to find my way back to the work. But it has always felt like an integral part of the work itself, that it's that fallow period that allows me for the soil to regenerate, from which something might possibly grow at some point. And I never stopped loving the work. I mean, that was perhaps a misapprehension, and I probably brought that on myself by opening my mouth, which I should have kept shut in the first place. But I never stopped loving the work. It's really, I've always wrestled over the years with I've been ill at ease with the sort of public aspect of the life and never really grown used to it. And for some reason, that sort of reached it reached a sort of a different level of intensity last time I worked.
Ronan, can I ask you how this project came about and how you came to write the screenplay with Daniel? Because I believe it started out as a short film, but then it expanded.
The initial idea actually was before my dad ever came to me to with the idea of us doing something together. For years, I'd had this vague idea of wanting to write something that had to do with brotherhood and with and the that kind of the tragedy and beauty of that archetype, because I have brothers, and it was just something that I felt that there was something in that that I could really throw myself into and was fascinating to me. But then in the meantime, I had other scripts that I was working on and was painting, and that kind of took center stage for me. And so then when my dad mentioned this idea to me, we were kind of casting around for ideas, and it turned out that he independently had this fascination with the idea of doing something about brothers and about the kind of silence between brothers and siblings, and almost like the telepathic communication and that charged negative space between two people that know each other on this almost like kind of spiritual level. And so we started kind of bouncing ideas back and forth, and we arrived at the idea of this person who's living in a state of kind of self-banishment in the middle of nowhere, and we didn't know where that middle of nowhere was, or like why he was living in a state of self-banishment, but we just knew that he was, and that his brother, who he hasn't seen in 20 years, shows up mysteriously at his doorstep at the outset of the story. And once we had that basic kind of scenario, it was really just about following both those characters in this confined space together, but then also the feeling that we had in the first images that came to us for the film, of just like the role of the weather and this kind of strange atmosphere and this sort of fizzing electricity.
And how did your own father-son dynamic influence the storytelling in the screenplay, influence how you were talking about the narrative and how I suppose, where the story went? I mean, especially when we think about the film's themes, which is, as you say, these complex ties between brothers and then also the complex ties between fathers and sons.
Right. Well, I think in a way it was our closeness that allowed us to explore the potential of an absent father, and what that would do, what that might do to a young person, and certainly in terms of Ray's experience too, having grown up in a house that had violence in it, as well.
I think since nothing about the film was like about this film's scenario felt autobiographical to me, I had to find a personal way in, and not that I was actively trying to find a personal way into it, but I think it developed in a personal way that revealed itself to us and to me over time, which is, I think, partially like that. Even though I didn't have that thing of the absent parent at all, like what you know the thing of someone being fascinated with the mystery of a parent's past life was something I felt like I could understand in terms of Brian's perspective. And even if you have a very close relationship with your parents, which I do, there's always that there's the kind of I guess superimposed over the present person that you know and feel that you understand deeply on one level, there's also a kind of stranger there that you'll never understand in the same way, I guess, partially because you've only been alive for like a fraction for like a part of their life. And so that was something that I felt I understood intuitively. And in terms of the brother aspect of it, I'm close with my brothers, very close with my brothers, but we have But I also that kind of the way that those sibling relationships can vault between like mirth and just like absolute rage in like seconds was something that was, I think, really like I didn't have to do any like, research into that.
It's our man on the inside of that experience, and I had a sort of lifetime of observing
as the referee.
Yeah.
Daniel, you've made work about the Troubles before. I'm thinking, of course, of your work on The Boxer and In the Name of the Father.
Yeah.
But why was it important for you to tell this story from the perspective of a British soldier who's so traumatized by his experiences in the North? Why was that important?
It sort of became imperceptibly became an integral part of the story, though we didn't set out with that intention. You know, Ray and Jem's life of soldiering came to us after we'd already sort of began to follow them in the reunion after this long estrangement. So, but certainly having spent so much time during the Troubles in West Belfast, specifically Twinbrook, with friends, Catholic friends, whose perspective of that conflict was so particular, it seemed then perhaps quite natural to want to examine it from the point of view of, you know, who were those young men in, you know, four-man teams on the streets of Belfast. And I remember being so shocked when I first started going to Belfast, and it was still basically the city centre. It was, you remember what it was like. Mm-hmm. You had to sort of go through a turnstile. It was almost like it was caged off, and that would be manned by fellows in uniform with weapons. And those teams would be out in the streets with their rifles swinging this way and that, and there'd be kids playing right next to them. And, you know, to see that kind of occupation in a city centre so close to my home in Wicklow, it just was shocking to me. But certainly, I think, you know, for both of us, it was a journey to try to imagine what the experience of those young men might have been. Not a point of view that's often examined, I don't think.
Yeah, and I mean, the character that you play, Ray, he's wrestling with past trauma, and he has these two remarkable monologues in the film where he's really finally communicating with his brother.
Yes.
How did you approach those two pivotal scenes? I suppose, firstly, when you're writing the script, and then as an actor, what was it like to go from the page to actually performing it?
Right. It was so unusual, the entirety of this work with Ronan, because the script largely developed through improvisation. And so before it became the written word, it was the spoken word, and it's almost invariably the other way around. And because Ronan was typing all of this, he was also, you know, as the language was refined and distilled, so he was writing, you know, version upon version upon version of the same scene. And then we would finally settle on something that we were happy with. But I think it certainly took the curse off it from the point of view of lifting the word off the page. I mean, that's very often, it can be a very beautiful thing to read a script. Not often is, but it can potentially be. But it's not, but then when you begin to speak it aloud, it might not have the rhythm that you need. It might not have the syntax that you need for that moment or that scene. And so I felt that gave us, we were a little bit ahead of the game from that point of view.
Can I ask you about working together, and what was it like for each of you to see the other working, to see the other one in a professional context?
Yeah,
it was, I mean, it was really thrilling because I had grown up watching, not actually watching him work directly, but being aware of him working and, you know, visiting set a couple times. And they had, when me and my younger brother were very young, they would take us with them when they were off shooting something. So I had a couple experiences of being able to kind of watch from a distance as these imaginary worlds were constructed, and then they would go into them and live inside them. But to be like, have a front row seat of the construction of one of those worlds and actually be constructing it together while also seeing him develop and almost like become the character as the script was being refined and revealing itself was such a indescribably strange and beautiful kind of experience. And then also to be on set together, I think was just like a really, it was hard to kind of absorb the just how, in the moment, how momentous it was to be able to work together in that way. But I think because we had had such a long gestation process of letting the script come together very organically over a few years, I realized in retrospect once we were on set that all that time had actually been preparation because we'd had so many of these really detailed conversations about the character that otherwise maybe we wouldn't have had the chance to languish in for so long. So I think that that was a huge gift and got made it so we had this shorthand on set.
And I think that's always, if you can find your way to that, it's always a huge benefit if the talking can be over by the time you get. Of course, things arise that need to be dealt with, but for the most part, the talking is done with. And I mean, I did allow myself a sense of immense pride to see Ronan becoming a film director in front of my eyes. And we also allowed ourselves occasionally, throughout the entire shoot, just like a shared moment of astonishment that we were being allowed to do this thing together. So,
And on that, this is obviously the first project that you're letting this project out into the world now, and it must be a lovely moment for you both. But is this be the beginning of a beautiful relationship? Can we expect more from you? Where will this lead to? Have you thought that far ahead yet?
Well, only theoretically, I think we both feel, of course,
We'd love
would
to
love
do
to
it again.
find, we've always been up to some kind of mischief since Ronan was a child, and I hope we can continue in that vein
I think
as long as we're able to.
I feel like the it's kind of a getting working on something like this together is almost going into like a shared psychosis or something that you need to find something that you can both get equally obsessed with. And I think that's there's no I guess you never know when something like that's gonna come, but I think we both really hope
Very
something
much
will.
so.
Well, Daniel Day-Lewis and Ronan Day-Lewis, congratulations on the film, and thank you very much for talking to Arena this
Oh, you're
evening.
very good.
Thank you
Thanks.
so
Thank you very
much.
much.
The winters, I mean, the isolation. How did I what? How did I manage without you? It's not over, Jem. I'm gonna make it sound as if it. I won't pretend I don't think about it from time to time, but this is it, Jem. This is my life. Does it have to be?
And that was, of course, Sean Bean and Daniel Day-Lewis in a scene from Anemone. Before that, we heard Daniel and his son, Ronan Day-Lewis, who directed the film, in conversation with Sinead Egan. Anemone goes on general release in Irish cinemas on Friday. We will be reviewing it on this Thursday's Arena. Train Dreams is a poignant adaptation by Clint Bentley of a novella by the late Dennis Johnson. Set in the early 20th century Pacific Northwest, the film stars Joel Edgerton as Robert Grainier, a logger and railroad worker coming to terms with personal loss as America undergoes significant and rapid change. Bentley, who directed from a script that he co-wrote with his longtime collaborator Greg Quaidar, paints a portrait of profound grief and radical transformation. I've been speaking with Clint Bentley and lead actor Joel Edgerton about the film, but first, let's hear something from it. You'll hear the voices of Joel Edgerton's Grainier, William H. Macy as Arne Peeples, and Felicity Jones as Grainier's wife, Gladys.
Beautiful, ain't it?
What is?
Beyond this, sir.
Well, I just couldn't stop walking until I got here.
What are you thinking about?
I was thinking that we ought to get married.
Joel Edgerton and Clint Bentley, welcome to Arena and thanks for joining us. Joel, I know you wanted to make this film for over a decade. It's a bit of a passion project for you. What was it about the original Dennis Johnson novella that captured your interest in the first place?
Well, I had read the novella and inquired after the rights. I hadn't really thought how I would go adapting the novella. It's just not the easiest thing to imagine just straight away turning into a film. But I did have the curiosity and found out the rights were taken. I guess I saw something of myself in the novella at the time I read it, but it was more the feeling I got from the book about what it said about the world and life as a in its entirety through the eyes of this sort of every man, every person. And that it was a Western and not a Western. It sort of had the beginning hallmarks of a Western, but it led into this very philosophically beautiful, elevated place. So there's a number of reasons why it struck me. And I'm very pleased that I didn't get the rights because Clint reached out to me strangely, randomly, you know, about four years ago, about a few years after I had read the novella. And that's the best thing that could have ever happened in terms of the events that I wasn't the one that got to make the film, but just to be in it.
Well, Clint, I'm going to ask you about that. You co-wrote and directed the film. It's quite a spare, quite a poetic initial story. So how do you go about turning that into what it is, which is quite a rich visual cinematic experience?
It's a good question. I felt in going back and reading it and thinking about it as a movie, I just felt like there was so much, kind of because it's spare and because the book is very open, you know, it's it'll jump in two sentences, it'll jump 10 years. I felt like there was a lot of cinematic possibilities to it. And I felt really excited about that. And just the to be able to have the visuals of this logging world, but also have this really intimate love story and the way nature comes in and plays with it, it just felt like it would be a cinematic playground, which it ended up being.
Joel, I'm conscious I haven't actually asked you about Robert Grainier, the man that you play in here. For a lot of the film, he's pretty much a hermit. Just tell us a little bit about him, about the character.
It's, you know, interesting that I've played quiet characters before, stoic characters before. There's something so pure about Robert. If I had to sum him up in one word, there's something really, it's purity. A virtuous man, kind, honest, generous. It's sort of, you know, the kind of person you wish there were more of in the world. But within those people there, I think there exists a deficit and a compression that they don't rail against the world they're in. They kind of get, the world does stuff to them and they don't presume to push the world or events or other people around. And I think they seem to soak up events. Good, you know, they receive good things, which they deserve, but like all of us, bad things happen to us. You know, there's something really gentle about Robert, which I think is good as a male character. I don't even know what my definition of masculinity is anymore. As a child, I thought it meant the tougher, more aggressive aspects of men. And I think masculinity to me now is a term that is so fluid and so hopefully harnesses the things I used to think it was, plus a deep sensitivity. And I think, to me, Robert is probably the most pure and lovely character I've ever played, and not your typical protagonist. And yet here it seems to really work that an audience can identify, because I think most of us feel like the world does stuff to us as well and that we're not in control.
How hard or how easy is it as an actor to create the performance in this film? Because there's not an enormous amount of dialogue to work with here, and quite a lot of the performance is physical with no dialogue happening. What was that like for you?
I knew going to work on this film that Clint was asking me to do something that that was more sort of in touch with my own experience than anything I've ever really done. Knowing that, you know, I'm not a logger, of course, but the physical aspects are part of the job to, you know, the task to undertake. But I am a husband and I am a father. And I think when you are those things, you've imagined the great things you have getting taken away from you. And I feel like all of these experiences are inside of me in a way that I don't have to stretch my imagination too much. And the non-verbal aspect of it was really about trusting the filmmaking and knowing that there was this wonderful narration that helps the audience sort of guide us and takes away Robert's need to be too verbal at times to undermine the nature of his sort of quiet character.
This is rough work, gentlemen. Not just on the body. We just cut down trees that have been here for 500 years. Upsets a man's soul whether he recognizes it or not.
That I'm her daddy.
Deep down, she knows it. Even if she doesn't know, she knows it yet.
Clint, as a director, there's an interesting dynamic at play here because your longtime collaborator, Greg Quaidar, he was a guest on Arena when Sing Sing was released, and you co-wrote Sing Sing with him, which he directed. But this time around, you're directing. What is it like for those roles to swap?
It's been a beautiful collaboration. We've worked together about 15 years now. And that's kind of how it always, we started as just two filmmakers who were helping each other out. First making our short films and then starting to get features off the ground with Transpacos, Greg's first film, and Jockey Mine. And it's just lovely having somebody in your corner who can help you put something together and be a good sounding board and a cheerleader when you need it and somebody to call you on your bullshit when you need it also.
The Clint, for you as well, the industrial expansion of 20th century America is the backdrop for this film, but the beauty of the Pacific Northwest, it's almost a character in and of itself in the film. How hard was it to balance that beauty with then the kind of destruction that's being created by the main character in this film?
I think exactly as you put it was something that we wanted to, all of us on the team wanted to bring across in the story. And what struck me about the story is that this person, Robert Grenier and all of these guys, they're participating in this destruction. But really it's like, it's being run by forces that are way larger than them. And these are just the kind of gig workers that are going from job to job. They have nothing to do with this like logging corporation and this war that's taking all of this wood. And that paradox is something I think we're still living with, where we're all carrying around phones in our pockets that are terribly destructive for the environment and for the people who make them a lot of times. And we're a bit outside of our control. And so wanting to like show that and show that paradox and also like really let nature be a character. And it's not just a backdrop for what these people are doing. The trees are a character just as much as the people. The horses have their own lives going on. And so that was really important.
In the forest, every least thing's important. It's all threaded together. So you can't tell where one thing ends and another begins.
Do you think bad things that we do follow us through life?
I don't know. I've seen bad men raised up and good men brought to the knees.
Joel, just as a final question for you, this film is like, it's a meditation on the passage of time, on how memory shapes truth. Tell me a little bit about how important it was for you that the film and the vignettes all come together at the end, because it is told quite in sections as you go along through one man's life.
There's a patience to the film that accumulates, I think, for people. I know it did for me, even as someone who finds it hard to be objective about viewing the film. But it in the same way that I had an accumulative response to Into the Wild, which is a film that I could compare this to in terms of isolation and wilderness, where we're never really forcing, even there's big marked events that happen in this film. It really is about memory and about the accumulation of an entire life and weighing it up against a sense of it being meaningful in some way. And what is that meaning and is it all worth it? I feel like the film just kind of keeps adding a layer upon layer upon layer that we then get to this significant piece at the end of the film where, as Robert does, and I imagine we all might on our deathbed or close to the end of our life, look back on our lives at a certain time as a series of snapshots that are good and bad and wonder to ourselves, what was the meaning of it all? And that is there to be answered for anyone in any individual seat watching the film.
I think it's a good place to finish. Joel Edgerton and Clint Bentley, congratulations on what is a beautiful film, and thanks for talking to us on Arena this evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's all going by so fast.
Beautiful, ain't it?
What is?
All of it. Every bit of it.
And that was director Clint Bentley and actor Joel Edgerton talking to me about Train Dreams. Incidentally, that gorgeous score that runs throughout the film is written by Bryce Dessner, and he's going to be a guest here on Arena this coming Thursday. Train Dreams opens in selected cinemas this Friday. Andrew O'Hagan is best known for novels including Caledonian Road, which came out last year, and Mayflies, which won the Christopher Isherwood Prize and was adapted into a two-part BBC TV drama of the same name. He's also a non-fiction author and has just published On Friendship, a set of 8 essays on a range of connections that he's made over the years, from early childhood to his relationship with Edna O'Brien. Richard Aldous has been reading On Friendship first, and he joins me on the line now. Richard, Mayflies is Andrew O'Hagan's fictional ode to boyhood friendship. It's interesting that he felt that he had more to say on the subject, but here in nonfiction, isn't it?
Thanks, Rick. Yeah, I mean, this is something which I think has been a preoccupation for Andrew O'Hagan for many years, that regular readers of the London Review of Books, where he's written for many decades, will know that this is something he's explored there too. And really, in some ways, there's a link with the your previous guest talking about Train Dreams, that in many ways, this book is a series of snapshots looking at his life, and in particular, looking at friendships that he's had, the meanings of friendships in all kinds of different ways, whether it's very famous figures like Edna O'Brien or Seamus O'Heaney, or childhood friends, or he even talks about his love of animals.
Okay, we're going to start at the beginning. He opens with reflecting on childhood, his first best friend, a guy called Mark MacDonald. And they used to signal each other with torches at nighttime. It borders on something from The Famous Five. What else do we learn about Andrew and about the nature of that early friendship in this?
Yeah, I mean, one of the points that he makes in this book is, of course, that he and me, he's the same generation as me, that we began our lives in analog and moved into the digital age. So, you know, this in many ways is a reflection on that analog childhood that he enjoyed. As you say, a lot of it is about flashing torches, the kind of independence that you had as a child at that time. He talks about the smells of things like striking a Brian and May match and smoking cigarettes that he'd nicked from his father and so on. But there is also a serious point to this, because his own childhood growing up in a very working class community in Glasgow with an alcoholic father and a mother who was a very committed Catholic, that friendship was the way in which he escaped from many of these things. So right from an early age, this kind of sense of both his own imagination, but then his own contemporaries, this was the way in which he constructed a life for himself.
Yeah, a lot of it is quite, maybe confessional is the wrong word, but through his friendship with Mark MacDonald, he does set that up as a contrast to all of those difficulties that he was going through at home. And then it kind of brings him to a sort of bid for freedom or a bid for independence.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, it's interesting in that first chapter, because, you know, I've read other books about childhood, in particular, Scottish childhood, Damien Barr's Maggie and Me, that in some ways is much more confessional and kind of doubles down on the kind of the horrendous aspect and the humorous aspect of childhood. Andrew O'Hagan is a much more reserved figure when he talks about these kind of things. But in some ways, that was his escape, that his escape was into this very literary, high-minded world. That was the way in which he constructed a reality for himself. And if you like, this book is a tribute to the fact that he committed to the life that he'd chosen.
He writes in it that, and this is a quote, romantic love gets all the headlines, but just as often it's strong friendship that properly describes the shape of your life. That's one of the central theses of the book, isn't it?
It is. And actually, one of the points that he makes is that it's very important not to confuse the two, that he gives a word of warning, something along the lines of, you know, any good friend should know that if they want that friendship to last, then you don't want to get in between your friend and their spouse. So, you know, this is definitely a book about friendship, sometimes over decades, sometimes imaginary friendships, you know. So in other words, characters in literature, but he also deals with the difficulty in friendship when someone who you've been very, very close to then dies, and what that then means for your life going forward.
There's two great literary influences in this book. So one is the English essayist William Hazlitt, and the other is James Boswell, the Scottish biographer of Samuel Johnson. Remind us who they were and why they made their mark, because one of those influences works better for you than the other.
Well, you're right. There are these two different influences. Hazlitt, the great essayist of the early 19th century, who would write these kind of beautiful essays on various kind of subjects, but would also write portraits in the way that Andrew O'Hagan has here. And then Boswell, of course, famously the great biographer of Dr. Johnson. And I think that, you know, in some ways, the essays, the Hazlitt influence. This is kind of something that speaks to the reserve, and it grew on me. Initially, I kind of thought that it was too reserved as I started the book, but once I came to see what he was doing, I could admire it. But I think the Boswellian character side of Andrew O'Hagan is where the book really comes to life, because he definitely has this ability, both in real time, to bring out his characters, and then having brought them out in real life, he's then able to translate that onto the page and bring them to life for us, so that some of the portraits of characters like Edna O'Brien and Seamus Heaney, Colm Tobin is another one, Carl Miller, the founder of the London Review of Books, these are absolutely fantastically done, and they are also fantastically funny, and I think that those are the moments that I will really take away from the book.
I wanted to ask you about the Edna O'Brien section in particular, because I laughed at that more than I think any other section of the book. It seems to be at the heart of unfriendship. And it starts with this glorious chance meeting outside his publishers. Tell us a little bit about the Edna O'Brien section.
Well, you're right. It's a fabulous meeting. And of course, this being public radio, I can't even tell you exactly what the meeting was, because she's getting out of a taxi. She's in the middle of a row with the taxi driver. She gets out. Andrew O'Hagan is about to get into the taxi, but she recognizes him. She knows who he is. And she kind of says to him, you know, I hate the effing English. Do you? And those are the very first words that she ever speaks to him. And so there's this kind of directness, and it's that directness that runs through the chapter, but also with this kind of fragility and also paradox. I mean, after all, Edna O'Brien is somebody who lived in England, in London, for 60-odd years, that she was celebrated in England. So there's this kind of ambiguity about the English, about the Irish. He goes back with her on a tour of County Clare. They end up in her old house, where he describes in brilliant fashion her fighting with herself, essentially, because clearly she hates it. She hates everything about this experience. And yet she's kind of desperate to be polite and to be civil to this woman who's been gracious enough to show her around her childhood house. So it's these kind of moments that are both very tender, very poignant, but also hilariously funny.
You do. You get the feeling in that particular encounter where Edna O'Brien has gone back into her childhood home and realizes that everything has been changed. And as a result of which, it's almost ruining her own memories of her own childhood home for her. But still, she manages to maintain some form of civility. I think she finishes off by saying, "You've done wonderful things with the place."
She does, and you know, as you did, you know, when I read that, I just laughed out loud. And this I think is Andrew O'Hagan's skill. I mean, it's Edna O'Brien, but these things, the effortless way in which he's able to put these things down on paper, so that we as readers are right there in the moment, it's a very skillful art to do that. And he does it brilliantly. And, you know, my favourite line in the entire book, which in many ways encapsulates this sense of fragility and humour, is that he goes to see her for the very last time before she dies. She's very ill by this stage. And he takes along a few bottles of champagne, because he knows how much she loves drinking champagne. And she takes a few sips, and then she just looks at him and says, "I think we can finally say, Andrew, that the great enemy is Prosecco." And it's just so beautifully observed, and yet also so touching, because of course it's that resilience and wit right to the very end of her life, exactly as we would have expected.
It's another reason to love Edna O'Brien so much. What many people will be interested in reading in this book are Andrew O'Hagan's literary friends. He spent a lot of time in Dublin over the years, and On Friendship is dedicated to Colm Tobin. What sense of the writer and their bonds does he give us in the pages?
Yeah, I mean, he's very good at doing this. He conjures all kinds of figures, including Colm Tobin, who, you know, he says that, you know, Colm Tobin taught me a lot about friendship just by being so good at it. And he tells lovely stories about Colm, for example, that, you know, silly things like, you know, he would send him a crate of oranges from Spain and so on. But also very touching things that a mutual friend of theirs who was dying, who was finding it very, very difficult emotionally going through those last days, and was in financial trouble. And Colm Tobin just sits down at the table. He kind of writes a check for a couple of £1,000 and puts it in. And Andrew O'Hagan just sees the note that he's put, and Colm Tobin, again, I'm going to have to edit myself here, but it just says, "Cash this, you effer." And it's, again, it's that kind of sense of comradeship, of friendship, of kind of incredible grace, but everything done with humour. And that is something I think that Andrew O'Hagan really, you know, he really values in all of his friends, because it's those moments of kind of humour, but also of grace, that are where the kind of we get so much insight into these characters.
You mentioned at the very beginning of this conversation that you've been reading Andrew O'Hagan in the London Review of Books for years. He got to know Seamus Heaney. He got to know Carl Miller, the legendary Scottish founder of the LRB, at the same time, roughly. And they were great friends themselves. He talks about that in the book.
Yes, I mean, Carl Miller actually is one of those characters who really emerges from this book. He has some wonderful lines when he's touring Scotland with Andrew O'Hagan and Seamus Heaney, and they have this kind of beautiful conversation about faith and belief, where he draws Heaney out to say that even if you lose your faith, having had it as a child, it gives you this sense of there being something beyond. He's in many ways he's a mentor to Andrew O'Hagan, and it's actually it's with Carl Miller that he sees that Andrew O'Hagan gives as the best example of not friendship, which is when they all three of them go off to see the Scottish poet Edwin Morgan, who is distinctly unfriendly to all three of them. And so, the three of them are able to laugh about it, but it also serves for us as an example of that kind of lack of empathy that sometimes there can be, even between people who you imagine there would be tremendous empathy.
Richard, how does he save this from being a massive exercise in name dropping?
Yeah, I mean, he talks a little bit about that. At one stage, he introduces kind of various characters and he says, that actually name dropping is an important part of friendship. I think it's when he's talking about talking about the Iraq War and so on. So that, yes, I mean, he does name drop, but he manages to do it with enough kind of sense of tongue in cheek and irony. That it doesn't become grating. And as I say, I think even though the first chapter was the one that perhaps I liked the least, nevertheless, that first chapter has laid the ground for precisely that. Because when you think that, of course, this working class boy from Glasgow who's committed to this literary life, he genuinely still revels in the fact that he's part of it, that he's friends with all of these people. It's the life that he wanted to live, and he's enjoying it. And that is on display to us as readers.
The thought just occurred to me as I was reading it, Richard. It's a beautifully put together book, and it's quite brief as well. It's only 130 odd pages or so, and it's on the subject of friendship. It might make quite a lovely gift book, and I don't want to bring Christmas into it, but it's too late now because I've said the word. It might make a lovely gift book at this time of year.
Yeah, because the nice thing about it is that I think you could probably read these in any order, that anybody who gets this as a Christmas present, I imagine, would probably just want to open it immediately to the Edna O'Brien chapter. And then you can work around it. But I mean, these are essentially portraits and you can enjoy them in that way, I think.
Richard Aldous, thank you so much for talking to us tonight. On Friendship by Andrew O'Hagan is published by Faber. Last chance to give you a reminder, because it's this Wednesday evening, we're going to be broadcasting live from the Dublin Book Festival at 1WML. That's in the Windmill Quarter in Dublin 2 in the South Docklands. If you'd like to be in the audience for the show, there are still some tickets available on the night. We are celebrating the 100th issue of the literary journal, the Dublin Review. The great panel on the night, the likes of Patrick Frayne and Sarah Baum and Mark O'Connell and Dhirin Ní Gcrífa. And I'm going to be talking to the journal's founder and editor, Brendan Barrington, as well. We'll have live music from Cuivine O'Rahilly and Sean McElhane, who are described as two of Ireland's most captivating contemporary folk artists. They launched their new album later in the week at the National Concert Hall, and we'll be having something from them on the night. All of the details, if you want to get some tickets, at dublinbookfestival.com. But of course, the whole programme will be live here Wednesday night from 7 on Arena. And that is it tonight from Arena. Sinead Egan was our producer. Researched tonight by Paula Shields. Ali Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator and Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound supervision. I'm Rick O'Shea. I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7 o'clock. Fiacna O'Brien is in for John Creedon and he'll be up after the news.